Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey and as always I'm joined by my co-host, Jamp, Luke Cutforth.
Hello.
And special guest, Spice 8 Rack.
Woo!
Welcome.
It's me, I'm here.
This week we're talking about a bounty of boyfriends, girlfriends galore, and a plethora of partners. But first, An Apple review. This one says, amazing, it is 5 stars, and it goes on to say, I always listen whilst making croissants, and you always make me laugh.
Oh, okay, very specific.
Very specific. How often is this person making
it's
croissants?
It's croissant time.
And a question for all of our audience, if you're listening on Spotify or Apple, go and use your eyes on YouTube and type in the answer to this question. Are you polyamorous, or would you be open to trying it?
That's for you.
The answer in the comments, please. Thank you.
Go on.
So shall we start the show?
Is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Does explain why I'm here.
That does explain why you're here. Yes. Why are you here? Why don't you explain to all of us and to our listeners and viewers why you're here?
Hello. Well, my name is Spice 8 Rack, otherwise known as Connor. Just get that out of the way early in case Corey starts referring to me as that and thus ruins the continuity. And I am I'm a polyamorous person. So since 2016, when I found out what polyamory was, I had never heard of it before then. I started having polyamorous relationships over the course of the last, 6 years now? Gosh, I'm thinking about it. Oh, is that maths? That's 6.
Yeah, about 6 years, I think.
Yeah,
or any number of years, because this is timeless.
True vibes. But at least since time recording, 6 years I've been being a polyamorous person in a variety of relationships, both polyamorous and monogamous. It's been blooming lovely. I've had a lovely old time. Did need a bit of learning though. Did need to learn a few new skills, a few new tricks of the trade and all that good stuff. But otherwise, having a ball, my friends.
Good to know.
Very good.
Well, glad you're here. So I'm going to ask a question to Jamp and Luke.
Oh.
What is the definition of polyamory?
Oh dear.
Go on, Jamp. You take it.
It's having... or being able to have multiple partners, having an interest in having multiple partners.
And loving them all.
And loving them all, equally or unequally. You can have a favourite if you want.
you can, yes. Very true.
Do you tell them? Do you tell the, or do you tell the others?
I mean, do you tell your kid that you've got a favorite kid? I don't know.
Yeah.
No, I think you'd mention if you've got a favorite, because that's an important part of the relationship, right?
Absolutely. One of the main and important facets of it in every relationship that you're ever in is always communication. But with polyamory, because you do have if you are engaging in sort of like polyamorous relationships, plural, you have multiple people's feelings to take into account. On a purely sort of pragmatic basis, you have multiple people's schedules to take into account as well. Like Google Sheets and Google Documents and Google Calendar, it's a polyamorous person's dream. Get to schedule everybody in. Oh, it's delightful.
Are we in a polyamorous relationship?
Oh, we are. We've got a shared Google Calendar.
We do have a shared Google Calendar.
Oh, that's sweet.
And I do find myself telling Luke and Jamp each that they're my favourite, so that they
pit
against one another.
He never tells us that he loves
everybody
us.
Everybody knows that a platonic polyamorous relationship or a polycule is called a podcast. That's the either that or a D&D campaign. Those are the two ones.
Depends whether it's being recorded or not.
Ooh la la.
Cambridge Dictionary. I've gone to get the definition from Cambridge Dictionary, because actually defining polyamory can be kind of tough depending on who you're asking. So the practice of having sexual or romantic relationships with two or more people at the same time. That's what Cambridge Dictionary says. I think that's pretty good. A little bit
this is my perspective as well, based on the fact that a lot of times I do a lot of political writing and political research. Sometimes dictionary definitions of things that are considered outside of the sort of like Overton window of what is normal in society. Oftentimes the definition can be a little bit lax or a bit lacking. So for example, the Cambridge definition, it said, could you quickly go over that one more time for me?
The practice of having sexual or romantic relationships with two or more people at the same time.
So I would go and say that it is entirely possible for you to be a polyamorous person and only be seeing one person at that time.
Oh, yeah, very true.
Right. In the same capacity, and I want to preface this with the whole, you know, the structure of relationship and sort of like sexuality within relationship are two very, very different things. Mm. But in the same capacity as a bisexual, let's say a bisexual man exclusively dating a cis woman, for example, that is not in any capacity denying that the guy mm-hmm. in that relationship is a bisexual person. Just because they are only seeing one person of one mm. gender doesn't mean that they aren't attracted to people of other genders at the same time. So I would say that, yeah, that's my perspective on that definition. What?
I just think that definition, though, I would have thought, or expected at least, that polyamory requires that everybody who's being polyamorized is sort of in on it. Jesus. Because that definition covers people who are having affairs. And would those people who are having affairs be considered polyamorous?
Very interesting.
No, that's... So I would say absolutely not, first and foremost, but I completely missed that. You're quite correct. That definition very much does cover...
It does.
The act of having... Yeah, because consent is never in any capacity brought up in that definition.
Yeah.
And that's exceptionally important. If you call yourself a polyamorous person and you have a partner and you start romantically, sexually seeing another person without telling that partner, then that is cheating. It doesn't matter if you're a polyamorous person, it doesn't matter if you're both polyamorous, it doesn't even matter unless you've pre-established that that is a fine thing to do in the relationship, which from my perspective would be a terrible idea, but if you had done that, it would be fine. But if you haven't, no, that's just cheating. That's just an affair.
I think the difficulty is that when we talk about polyamory, people don't think about it in the correct way, or people think about it in a way that limits their understanding of it. So you're talking about consent in polyamory, and the only reason that we need to explicitly say that is because people would assume that you don't need to have consent from all parties. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, really, when we think of polyamory, it's the same as any relationship. All relationships have boundaries and limitations and agreements between people that are in them. We just tend not to talk about a lot of those, right? So it's usually kind of a given that if you're in a monogamous relationship with someone, or rather, if you're in a relationship with just one person, it is almost assumed that you are going to be monogamous to a relatively average degree, right? Wherein you're not going to have sex with someone else, you're not going to have romantic relationships with anyone else. But then you also have these difficulties of, like, some people will say that texting someone is cheating, right? So my point here is that in all relationships, you need to establish boundaries. And we tend to think, we tend to kind of have a set of expected boundaries that we just take for granted in traditionally monogamous relationships, which can't really be the case in polyamorous relationships, because they are, to an extent, a deviation from the norm.
Yeah.
That scans. No notes. Perfect.
So moving on to ethical non-monogamy, I just want to briefly touch on that, because you could kind of class it under polyamory, but ethical non-monogamy tends to focus more on sexual relationships, and generally, from what I've read, it seems that people would view ethical non-monogamy as partners generally being romantically or emotionally monogamous but more sexually open. Obviously, definitions differ based on who you ask, but is generally what I find. It's what I found in scientific papers. That's what I'm saying to you. That generally, when people talk about ethical non-monogamy, they're usually talking about being open in terms of sex rather than being open in terms of having equal committed relationships with other people. Not necessarily even equal committed relationships with other people, but committed relationships.
Certainly some kind of commitment, for sure. Yeah.
Exactly. Shall we maybe go through some types of polyamorous relationship?
Oh, yes.
Love to.
I didn't know how many types there were.
Do you want to try Pokemon?
That's fun, right? We'll try and catch them all. Do you want to try and name any types of polyamorous relationship? And this is all coming, by the way, from a website called Choosing Therapy. It's been reviewed by a doctor.
Okay.
A doctor has reviewed this.
I would guess an open relationship is a form of polyamorous relationship.
It's not on my list, Luke.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Would
you like to add it to your list?
Would you like to describe what you mean by
an open... but I think an open relationship is sort of a modification of a traditional monogamous relationship, where you're able to sort of
deviate slightly, mm-hmm. But you're not going to form another relationship with another person. So but you can have sex with people, maybe, I don't know.
That sounds like the first one on my list, which is hierarchical poly. So that would, it sounds like what you're describing there would fall under that. So,
you got a bae, but then
you got a favorite.
A secondary bae. Yeah, you got a favorite. Like, exactly.
I mean, like, I think like it's the thing is though that like having a conversation where you have like a hierarchical monogamous polyamorous relationship, it is, you know, you have a main relationship, you have the person that you are, for example, committed to in terms of like the long term, and you might have other people who you are committed to in an equally sort of passionate or romantic or sexual capacity, but there is that understanding that there is one or two people within this entire sort of relationship structure that I have, that you have with me, that come before everything. Yeah. So you can't, that's it is funny to say like, oh, I have a favorite. That is a funny way to perceive it, but like, it's not like too far from the sort of reality of some polyamorous relationships. Yeah. Obviously not all polyamorous relationships are like that, but that's certainly the case in some of them.
I feel like we need to pull out our stock phrase, the thing we always have to say whenever we're talking about any group of people. Polyamorous people are not a monolith. There is an incredible amount of diversity of thought amongst polyamorous people. So what we're talking about today does not necessarily describe all polyamorous
more
people.
More than one experience.
More but than one experience.
All, we all love waistcoats.
That's true.
That's the monolith.
Across the board.
The monolith. All polyamorous people.
That's how they spot each other. Whenever you see a girl.
I wore a waistcoat to my wedding.
Ooh.
What a mistake.
Oh, that was very confusing. Yeah, we were all talking about it. We were like, that's a really odd thing for him to do. But
I know
okay.
You were trying to pick up people at your wedding.
So you spent so much time like not talking to the bride, you know, before the wedding. It was very confusing.
If I was at that wedding and seen you wear a waistcoat, I would have gone, oh, so that's the favourite. Okay.
That's the favourite.
The one that's getting married to him. That's the
favourite,
got it.
Just letting everyone else know who the favourite was.
Was she in a waistcoat as well?
Under the dress,
Under the dress.
So, yeah, a hierarchical poly would probably describe what you're talking about there as an open relationship. Generally, these are where you've got sort of primary relationship, and then you can explore secondary relationships. Again, I've seen people talk about this in multiple places, saying this kind of relationship structure can be unhealthy. Essentially, some people don't like the idea of hierarchy in relationships. I personally think that that's maybe a bit short-sighted, because there's always a hierarchy in terms of, not necessarily always a hierarchy in terms of relationship, but in terms of certain needs and whatnot, you're going to have hierarchy. Someone that you're more likely to turn to for X thing, or someone that you enjoy doing Y thing more with. And I think denying that for the sake of making sure that everyone feels as though they are equally valued is potentially more unhealthy than being open and honest about just your relationships with people.
I think it also loses sight of the fact that there are lots of different reasons and types of relationship. Like, there's quite often depicted in TV and film. I don't know how common it is in the real world, but often there's like a sort of power couple depicted who are maybe like later on in like middle-aged life, and they're sort of power couple. They're still together. They've been together for a while, but then they both explore sexual relationships outside of that couple. Maybe they don't want to have sex with each other anymore, or maybe they just want to have fun, but they stay together. A relationship is not just about that thing. They stay together because they're partners in life. And they might want to try out other things. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just on two things. I think the term open relationship, from my perspective at least, does fall somewhat outside of the umbrella of polyamory, and is more a term used by people who for the most part view their relationship as a monogamous one, but there is some element of having sex or having sexual relationships outside of that relationship, but the core of it is monogamy. A hierarchical polyamorous relationship may look quite similar, but will have certain qualitative differences, and certainly will have a different foundation to the relationship. And not to say that open relationships or hierarchical polyamorous relationships are better or worse than one another. I think there is sort of just a that qualitative one is based more in monogamy, one is based more in polyamory. And I would on the topic of sort of hierarchy in relationship, I think that there from sort of like anarchist writing on my wall. It's got to pop out at some point. But like no, I feel that when it comes to having non-hierarchy in relationships, it completely depends on what you mutually decide amongst yourselves. Because in some polyamorous relationships, like a hierarchical one, you have sort of, you know, central two people and then other people. But in a polycule where, you know, people came together roughly at the same time, or maybe that, you know, everyone lives together in sort of like a house or a commune or something like that, then there can be a much easier way of establishing a non-hierarchical relationship. Whereas if you're, for example, if you were living with your partner and were trying polyamory out and brought someone else into the relationship, and maybe you are seeing them, or maybe you and your partner are seeing this other person, the fact that you are living with one person naturally, just purely based on the material conditions in which you both live, is going to create the create a hierarchy, as opposed to hierarchies naturally occurring within relationships. It's more sort of a case of the conditions in which you find yourself.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my point is not that hierarchy is necessary in relationships or is inevitable in relationship necessarily, just that anyone advocating this type of relationship is wrong. What it usually comes from them not personally feeling comfortable with said type of relationship, you know, unless we're talking about abusive relationships or and whatnot. But yeah, you know, you can have hierarchy.
Surely,
obviously.
That's
obviously
one of the types of polyamory, abusive polyamory. What? But that's the one the doctor put a big red X next to.
No. But you know what I mean in terms of if someone is saying to you, a hierarchy in relationships is inherently bad, probably isn't. If you're comfortable with it, it's probably fine. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, so long as everyone is comfortable, safe, and happy, you're good.
Just the way? Ain't that just the way, baby?
Let's just quickly, I'm just going to quickly run through some other types of polyamorous relationship that I've found, just to give you an idea, because I guess we tend to focus on the sort of, anchor couple or sort of anchor partners, where you've got sort of two people and then there are other relationships outside of that, basically because most people are looking at this from a monogamous point of view. So necessarily you're going to view it through that lens that you are most sort of comfortable with. So some more types of polyamorous relationship. You've got a triad, which can often be described as a sort of thruple. It's essentially two partners who are open to dating a third person, but only together. That's another one that you would probably more commonly hear about because it more easily fits into a sort of monogamous lens. Then there's a quad, which is sort of couples that choose to date other couples. Again, easier to understand through a monogamous lens. Then there's, there is a V, which is apparently one person who dates two people separately. So, yeah, that makes sense?
Makes the shape of a V.
Yeah, makes the shape of a V.
Yes.
But they don't date each other.
No.
Yeah.
No.
That's a triangle.
So they could, so these people might never know each other, or they could be friends with each other, but they're not romantically involved with each other.
Cool.
Then there's something I'm sure Connor would absolutely love, which is relationship anarchy.
I was gonna suggest this because of the hierarchy one. I was like, is there the flip side of that?
Yeah.
Anarchistic. Polyamory.
None of you tell each other which one's the favorite.
this is a relationship structure wherein,
or you tell everyone that they're the favorite.
but maybe everybody is the favorite.
Exactly.
Thing.
Or a different
there
day.
Is no the favorite.
Another day, another favorite.
We're all favorites.
You gotta pull your head out of this sort of hierarchical lens of favorites, Luke. Yeah. There are no favorites.
Okay.
Or maybe
there are genuinely no favorites in relationship anarchy.
Or maybe there are favorites, but for different. So in relationship anarchy, now let's be serious about the actual definition of this. Relationship anarchy is not about. It's more about sort of not having these sort of rules or labels or hierarchy as restrictions. You just let things sort of follow their course, really.
Cool. Right.
You know, you're not saying you can't date this kind of person, or I have veto on that. It's just people that are making relationships without sort of
kind of like friendships.
Yeah,
kind of like the you don't have set rules in your friendships. You don't if I spend a week with Jemp, no one's going to tell me not to do that. And there are is that fair? I don't mean that as a joke. I mean that's the,
no. I think that is very fair. I think that it's I have sort of only like what I can see from very sort of like queer scenes that I'm a part of, and you can see sort of people who are in committed relationships with like between two people or with three people going and dating someone else for a time, and that becomes a different relationship. And maybe it could even be a case of, you know, committed relationships transition from a sexual one to a sexual and romantic one into just a platonic one or back again and stuff like that. And just as very much as Corey said, sort of like letting things go with the flow, as it were. I would say that like it's something that I find difficult to... I personally wouldn't ever want to necessarily be involved too heavily in an example of relationship anarchy. First off, I'm not an anarchist. second off, it's a case of the more people who are involved in any sort of polyamorous situation, the more people that you need to be communicative with and like get consent from as well. And there is a fine line between feeling free to, you know, see whoever you want, date whoever you want and stuff like that, and also making sure that people whose feelings may necessarily be injured in some way by you acting like that, making sure that they are okay and making sure that everyone is having a good time.
I mean to kind of bring it back to friendships, to use that as a sort of easier way of understanding it, you know, you could be friends with as many people as you want, really, but if you start having more and more friends, you're going to need to spend more time with those friends and necessarily less time with other friends.
Yeah.
So that could then mean merging those friendships so that you become a group of friends who spend more time together, and then everyone gets to spend that time with you. Or it means having a conversation with your other friends as to why you're suddenly not spending as much time with them. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, there's, and also if you've got one friend who might have a very specific problem with another person that you don't have a specific problem with, you might want to have a conversation with that initial friend if you're going to start spending time with the person that they've got a problem with.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, essentially what this is about communication, which is why I think most people are probably think that polyamory is very difficult, because people are terrible at communication.
Somewhat to jump off of that, because I've been poly for 6 years or so. I've had a lot of people in my life who have come and who have gone, who have like I've talked to them about polyamory, and they've gone, oh, that sounds really interesting, I want to give that a go, or like me and my partner want to give that a go, and stuff like that. And invariably, when people just view it as, oh, we can just be romantically or sexually involved with whoever we want, and let's just be free, invariably it becomes a problem, because they're not necessarily communicating. They're still viewing this, as Corey's been saying, like viewing it from a monogamous lens of like, for example, I've known people who have started being polyamorous or opened their relationship up in some sort of poly capacity, and then been anxious about telling their partner that they are sort of romantically or sexually attracted to or even involved with another person, because in their head they're like, oh, but what if that makes them uncomfortable, and what if that's, they consider that cheating and stuff like that. And so rather than having that conversation and kind of having that confrontation and that potential uncomfortability, they then just go, I simply won't say anything. And then the relationship explodes.
Yeah.
Because if you don't talk to your partner, regardless of if you're monogamous or polyamorous or in a anarchistic polyamorous commune, good for you if you are, and that's working out for you. Love to you. You've got to communicate. It's the basis. You've got to get communication. You've got to get consent.
And I think the fact that most people, this is something that I'm not basing this on research I've read. This is squarely my opinion based on my experiences and blah, blah, blah. Okay. Disclaimer's done. Okay. I'm going to say what I think now. So I feel that most people fall back on the fact that they are in traditional relationships as an excuse to not have conversations with each other that they might need to have. So people aren't necessarily as communicative as they need to be about their feelings or anything in the relationship, because they're basically just following a standard sort of model of how relationships go, yeah. Right? They just have assumptions and expectations, and they don't bring up when there are problems. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's why you see a lot of jokes that from straight men that hate their wives, because...
Yeah,
so many jokes.
Why did you marry her if you don't like spending time with her?
When she talks.
And like, or people that are like, my husband never does anything romantic for me. Have you communicated it to him in a way that he understands? Or have you asked him why he's not able to do that for you?
Yeah.
And if all of these things are the case, why did you marry a man that doesn't fulfill your needs? Like, just speak to people.
That's what I'm supposed to do. That's my job.
You even see this when it comes to sort of sexual relationships as well. You know, people just don't know how to have sex with each other,
yes.
Both of them, to enjoy it. It's actually shocking. Speak for yourself! Shocking.
Oh! Sorry. It was right there.
Sorry, who's people?
A friend of mine, someone that was speaking to someone very close to me, who I won't name. Definitely not me.
Asking for a friend.
Sorry.
But no, I think that I genuinely think that relationships would be better served by more open communication, which is why I think a lot of relationships are pretty poor. Why divorce mm-hmm. rates are probably so high. Probably.
My wife had a very funny interaction. So me and my wife have each other on Find My Friend,
mm-hmm.
so that we know when each other are home or like that kind of thing. And this guy was like, she was like watching me on the map when she was with this guy. It was like, I was coming to pick her up and she was like, oh, he'll be here in a couple of minutes. And this guy was like, oh, that's really creepy. And she was like, why? We trust each other. She's like, oh, when you get married, that'll end. Don't worry. He'll be wanting to stay late at the office. He'll be wanting to say he's staying late at the office, but actually he's at the pub with his friends. And I was like, firstly, you don't know me at all. I don't have an office.
Job.
I don't go to the pub with my friends. Rarely I do. And if I do, my wife's there. But he was like, that'll end when you get married. Well, that man's divorced now.
And I feel that the closest you've got to being at the office... and also going is for drinks with your friends is this yeah. is Sci Guys
yeah.
And whenever you want to stay here after Sci Guys, you call your wife to ask her permission,
and she's always like yes. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm allowed to make decisions. Fantastic.
Beautiful.
But it is genuinely shocking how okay, so you've got partners that don't know the passcodes to each other's phones, and that's perfectly fine if you don't want your partner having the passcode to your phone, but sometimes it's useful to have the passcode. And also, when people don't want partners having the passcode, a lot of the time it comes down to the fact that they don't trust them not to just go through their phone, which yeah. I feel like is a very odd thing. Like, one, why would they do that if you've asked them not to, you know? And why would they also then be suspicious enough to be going through? There's so many problems
there. It's like
when
they invented private mode on Internet Explorer and they were like, this can be used when... For example, you're purchasing a birthday present for somebody and you don't want it to be in the history. It's like, yeah, sure, man. That's what that's for. Definitely. That's what that's for.
And also, like, you're in relationships where regularly your significant other will check the internet history to see what has happened on that computer.
I'll check it
like,
every day.
It's a very, very strange... Again, it's a lot of sort of, like, the basis of a lot of relationships and the basis of what people perceive in relationships is that they just don't communicate and that things are left unsaid and that privacy is necessary, because if you found out everything like that I was doing or that I was thinking at any given time, we would suddenly have a massive conflict. And that's the good thing about being a polyamorous person or in a polyamorous relationship is that for it to succeed, you necessarily have to do that. You can be in a monogamous relationship. From at least my perspective, you can be in a monogamous relationship and it lasts many, many, many years and keep a lot of secrets. Lots and lots of older married couples do that with each other. And from my perspective, I don't think that's a good thing, but there is a functional relationship there that isn't going to explode at any given moment. You try and do that in a polyamorous relationship, you are going to completely ruin your relationship with one or two or many, many different people.
Just too many people to keep secrets from, really.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Too many people to have on Find My Friends.
Exactly. Scrolling for days. No.
Just looking like the Snapchat man.
So I just want to quickly point out that there are other kinds of polyamorous relationships as well. You could have something called polyfidelity, which if you think of that as a relationship between multiple people where they're not seeking any further romantic or sexual relationships. I just wanted to point that one out because that's
like a closed loop.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Cool. I mean, the same way that one might think of any monogamous relationship, except in this case, there are just some more people.
Just some more people
they're involved. Inclusive, but to each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just feel the need to bring that up because it's quite important to understand that polyamory isn't just constantly adding more and more people to the repertoire, necessarily.
Yeah.
So there isn't a huge amount of research on polyamory, which is why we spent, I think, maybe, what, the past 20, 25 minutes talking about just types of polyamory. But there's some research here and there. I can't find a whole lot of studies on polyamory in humans in general, though. A lot of the stuff you'll find is about monogamy and the move from more polyamorous relationships to monogamous relationships in humans or in animals in general. Although, using the term polyamory there is kind of stretching the definition a bit. Usually it'd be polygamy or polygyny or polyandry.
Yeah.
Basically,
all terms with which I am intimately familiar.
To describe what those terms mean, polygamy refers to marriage, generally, is used in humans. So you've got polygyny, which would be many females, and polyandry is many males. Yeah? Yeah.
Gotcha.
So how do British people feel about polyamory?
Not too positively.
I don't want to know, mate.
So I've got this from YouGov. The question was, by polyamorous relationship, we mean a relationship where people have multiple relationships with different partners at the same time, with the consent of everyone involved. Have you ever been, or do you think you could ever be, in a polyamorous relationship? 80% of people said no, they have not heard of it, and they would not be open to it. 9% of people said no, but they would be open to it. 1% of people said yes, they have been open to it. Yes, they have been in a relationship. Yes, they know what it is, and they have been in a polyamorous relationship. Okay. Yes.
Good to see. Polyamorous people join the fantastic crew of the gingers and the
trans people.
No, is it trans people or is it
intersex people?
Intersex people. Of being 1% of the population. Congratulations.
1-2%. Yeah. Well, that's not necessarily true, though, because there's also people who are currently in a polyamorous relationship and obviously would be in a polyamorous relationship and some others. But you can find this on YouGov. It's all linked below. Essentially, what you could take away from this is that 80% of people have not been in a polyamorous relationship and do not want to be in a polyamorous relationship in the UK, which leaves 20% of people
to pick from.
To pick from, maybe.
Or to try and convince.
Or 20% of people who have been... there's also some of those 20% that have been in a polyamorous relationship and wouldn't want to do it
anymore.
I would always take surveys like this with like huge like a big old honking load of soul, because like, you know, there is, I think for a lot of people, their perceptions of what polyamory is going to be pretty much, I mean, the like, as someone who has used dating apps as a polyamorous person in the past, the amount of people who I've sort of matched with and had a conversation with who I've then talked about, put polyamorous in my bio and stuff like that. And for the majority of people who match, they understand what that is and they're cool with it. But for the few who know what it is, but like aren't cool with it, I've had so many people don't know what it is and have matched with me. It is a case of like the conversations go something along the lines of, this is like cheating, but it's allowed, right? That's what that is. And it's like, literally, I think I had heard the phrase cheating by consent.
It's like lying, but you're telling the truth when you're doing it, right? It's like lying with the truth, right?
So like of that 80% of people, I mean, in a very similar capacity, there was a very, very, I was about to say funny, but it's sort of more in the darkly comedic capacity. There was a poll that showed recently that 40% of Americans think that Russia today is a communist state, which, like, and that's a significant portion of the population who are just objectively incorrect about the material facts of the world. And so that 80% of people who have heard about what polyamory is or who haven't heard about what it is but wouldn't want to go anywhere near it probably just haven't met and had a conversation with a poly person who's just like, it's really not that scary, pal. It's all good.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think that when it comes to polyamory, I feel like it's one of those things that is somewhat as you said, not very well understood. And so people are very hesitant to try it out, I guess. But also, because our society is very much set up without polyamory in mind, I feel like that holds a lot of people back. In the same sense, we've spoken before about how there are people who could be described as bisexual who don't sort of identify as bisexual because of, I guess, social stigma or not necessarily needing to identify as bisexual. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
That's fair enough. I also think to a certain degree, if like some people who by all intents and purposes could be described from the outlook as being either monogamous or polyamorous or bisexual or straight or something like that, if they choose to just go, I don't think that's what I am, like, that's fair enough. Yeah. You do you, my love.
So let's talk about the prevalence. How prevalent do you think polyamory is in America? Because that's what I've got the stats for.
Not very.
Not very? Can you put numbers on not very?
1%.
Are we talking nationwide or by specific state? Because I guarantee that the rates in California versus Oklahoma are going to be wildly different.
So this is nationwide. So I've got a 0.6 to 5% point prevalence and a 2 to 23% lifetime prevalence. That means that at any one point in, you know, in time, you've got 0.6 to 5% of people would be in sexually non-exclusive relationships. That's how it was defined in this survey.
Yeah.
And over their lifetime, 2 to 23% of people would be in one of those relationships.
2 to 23%.
Yes, 23 is quite high.
Quite a margin.
Where is that 10 times modifier brought in? How does that work?
Woodstock.
Look, this is... I guess it depends on the survey questions and who was surveyed and how you extrapolate that outwards, obviously. You know, there's lots of things that go into it.
I just think at that point, there's no point asking the question.
Between 0 and 100.
Yeah, I mean, it's anywhere between 2% and almost a quarter.
Yes.
Under a quarter, that gives you a good idea. Yeah, but I mean, obviously, it's a tough thing to understand. I mean, it was only coined, I think, in the 90s, the term polyamory. It was made sort of in two separate contexts within 2 years. So it was first used by Morning Glory Zell Ravenheart in a 1990 newsletter of the Neo-Pagan Church of All Worlds. And it came from the science fiction book Stranger in a Strange Land, written by Robert A. Heinlein. Or Heinlein? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The second time that it was brought up was by Jennifer Wesp, who was looking for a word that could be used to mean non-monogamy, and ended up calling her mailing list alt-polyamory in 1992. And then since then, obviously, definitions have been sort of added and debated and all of that. So this is coming from Defining Polyamory, a Thematic Analysis of Laypeople's Definitions, which is a paper published in 2021. It's quite good if you'd like to have a look at it. It kind of looks into how people don't know what polyamory is. that's what it's looking at. Yeah, it's all over the place when you ask people what they think it is. So that'd be the prevalence of polyamory generally, what it is, and what the British people think of it. Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
It sure is.
It's the ad bell.
Well, the ad gods have asked us to promote our Patreon on this episode.
Hell yes.
Thanks to our patrons over at patreon.com/SciGuys. You get SciGuys every single week. But if you become a patron, you can get a whole host of other things. What can they get if they join our Patreon?
An extra episode a month.
You can get access to our super secret Patreon podcast, After Dark. Just because SciGuys has ended doesn't mean the conversation has.
That's right. And you can also vote on episode topics, submit episode topics for the vote. And some patrons can just get rid of democracy altogether and tell us exactly what episode they want us to make. You get bonus clips, behind the scenes stuff, lots of cool stuff over on our Patreon. You should definitely go and check it out right now. Patreon.com/SciGuys.
Don't miss it.
I agree.
Let's start the show again. Let's talk about animals, because a lot of animals are not monogamous.
Oh, okay.
Our badger's monogamous.
Why do you ask questions like that? I don't know. Let's
Penguins
find out.
Are monogamous. So,
badgers are usually monogamous.
Great.
Yes.
Usually. Okay.
Well, they can be turned.
Usually. 2 to 23% of the badger population.
I got into a YouGov poll.
of badgers.
We asked all badgers.
Actually, interestingly, 50% of YouGov polls are done with badgers. That's why you can't really trust them. Because,
interesting.
Yeah, badgers are notoriously...
Yeah, we seem to be wrong.
Wind in the Willows is just a fictionalized polycule. We have established this now.
So, back to the animals. We figured out that badgers are usually monogamous. Are you happy with that one, Luke?
Yeah, but I mean, that's saying nothing of socialization. You don't know that society isn't enforcing the badger's monogamy.
Jesus. Okay, that's very true. Badger society could be forcing badger monogamy onto those badgers. But what percentage of mammal species do you think are monogamous?
2 to 23%.
Yes,
it is within that. It's within
17%.
Yeah,
lower, way lower than that.
I'm gonna say 5% or something like that.
Well, that's closer. So 9% of mammal species. That's 226%. Of mammal species. Not 226%. 226 mammal species, which is about just under 9% of all mammal species, are monogamous. And even in the groups of species where monogamy is more common, it's not even necessarily as common as you think. So, for example, primates, which we are primates, they have about a quarter of species under primates are monogamous.
Oh, God.
Ah.
Yeah, no, so not that many. So monogamy in humans, when do you think that started? Or not necessarily humans, in our ancestors, really.
With the establishment of the church.
No. No, with the establishment of Homo erectus about 1.9 million years ago, that's when we think monogamy probably started with our lot.
That is interesting to me, though. That really is, because I would have assumed that it was a more sort of like socialized through, I don't know, like classical civilization, sort of ancient Greek style. But even then, now I'm thinking about it, that there's a huge sort of culture, particularly in like Rome, of sort of like group sex and like lots and lots of relationships and concubines and the like.
And that's why we should be quite specific about what we mean in regards to monogamy. So we'd usually describe humans as being socially monogamous, but not sexually or genetically monogamous.
Oh. So
this is from BBC Science Focus. It says, we usually live as couples, but the relationships aren't permanent and some sex occurs outside of the relationship.
Serial monogamy. Plus some sexies.
But then that wouldn't
that
wouldn't really truly be monogamy. It's in a sense, it's almost like describing yourself as vegan, except for the times when you eat meat. You know,
yeah, the old egg.
Yeah, no, I'm vegan for maybe 3 years at a time, and then I'm not vegan for a while, and then I find some vegan food, and I decide to be vegan again.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that by that standard, quite a significant chunk of the human race is unmonogamous.
I mean, in practice, technically, I mean, it depends on how you sort of define monogamy. So in this sense, social monogamy means that you're essentially having one partner at a time.
Yeah.
So you can have a new partner and you might have sex outside of relationships. But generally with humans, when you have a partner, you intend to stick with that partner for the foreseeable future.
That's interesting.
Essentially for life.
Because there is a difference. Which one? Because I don't even necessarily know what monogamy is then in that case. Like, is monogamy the practice of having one partner and sticking with that partner for life? Or is it the practice of having one partner at a time? Because I thought having one partner at a time was serial monogamy.
So serial monogamy means one partner after the other. So when something is serial, it means one after the other, after the other, after the other sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So serial monogamy would generally be used to describe someone that is hopping directly from relationship to relationship with not much time in between.
That's how my mum would describe me, yeah.
That makes sense. But monogamy is just having one mate at a time. Some animals will mate for life.
Yeah. So what's that? Extreme monogamy.
Sure. Yeah. Let's call it. Let's go with that. I don't know if there's. I mean, usually I just hear
it's what penguins do, don't they?
Mating for
and
life.
Swans. Yeah.
Well, birds tend to be.
Swans
birds
don't like make out and a bit, and then you're like, nah, not for me, and then carry on.
The first one, they're like, oh, perfect. yeah, you're for me.
Ooh. Cracking.
90% of birds are monogamous.
Damn.
90%. Yeah. And so there's a lot of different explanations for why monogamy might have developed, because if you think about it, monogamy doesn't necessarily make sense from an evolutionary standpoint in a lot of cases, right? Why would you think it wouldn't make sense?
Well, it wouldn't make sense because you are reducing your own genetic diversity.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So from a sort of, let's say, evolutionary perspective, you probably want to have a more polyamorous structure to relationships, because you can, for example, under under the umbrella of polyamory, you could have children with multiple different partners and therefore have a more diverse sort of second generation or next generation. And you could also share the load of raising said offspring with multiple different partners, which could then increase the chances of said offspring surviving. So that would be why you'd think maybe polyamory would be best, but there are obviously...
Does that not risk the next generation mating with their half-brothers and sisters?
Not really.
No?
No.
I think that if you look at it, I mean, if you were to consider it from sort of like a perspective like historical materialism, that it would have to be a case of there is some kind of protection over the sort of like means of subsistence and the means of reproduction, aka food, shelter, and stuff, that is in some way benefited by monogamous relationships as opposed to a more polyamorous structure. So I have to imagine it would have something to do with like structure of early settlements or even just structures of like early groupings of Homo erectus just being, I don't know, maybe... I couldn't think of actually why. I'm sure you've got the answer before you.
I do have the answer before me. Well, I say I have the answer before me. We don't actually know. I need to preface it with that. We don't really know why exactly.
They don't even know. They probably don't know either.
Yeah, you know, you pop back in your time machine, look at Homo erectus, they would probably not be very happy with you. Yeah. You know?
That is a strange rock that you have there.
And then smack you with their much harder rock. You know?
Yes. My rock wins, yay! Now to be monogamous.
So what I'm trying to say here is that essentially with non-monogamy, it seems as though there are more evolutionary pressures to keep that because it seems quite beneficial. But obviously there are pressures against it. We just don't necessarily know what all of those might be. But for example, if you have fathers, say, siring multiple children with different partners, it could then lower the chance of the father actually caring for the offspring, right? Because their goal is just spread seed as much as possible. Don't stick around to see it grow. But then if you stay close to prevent your partner cheating, then you could then share in the sort of load of raising the offspring, which could then increase the chance of the offspring sort of, I guess, surviving to adulthood, right? And in that case, sticking around with a partner to stop them from cheating would then essentially mean that you're then sort of more inclined to be monogamous, and that could be how monogamy has come about. But I found a paper.
I don't necessarily agree with the phrase "sticking around to prevent the partner from cheating." I think you're sticking around because you've evolved to stick around. No,
if there's a behavioral thing of sticking around to stop your partner from cheating, for example, you mate with a female. And you think, I don't want this female to mate with any other males.
Yeah.
Because I want them to focus on raising my genetic offspring.
Yeah.
Then you're going to stick around with that female, right?
Right.
And then that could be what led to monogamy.
But it's just applying sort of like a modern, like the modern terminology to a much earlier and like qualitatively different, but still kind of similar structure.
Yeah. So, I mean, we wouldn't probably describe it as cheating. It's just stopping your mate from mating with others.
But I mean, especially if you give the example of like in that situation where you're a male and you've mated and you're sticking around to prevent your sexual partner from cheating. Well, especially in the case of a human mother, there's an awful lot of resource investment that's gone into creating a human baby, of time and food and the risk to you and everything. So you might cheat, yes, but you're also quite likely to raise that child to adulthood, regardless of whether the male sticks around or not. So
offspring with other, as a male, you don't necessarily want to have lots of other competitors for your offspring.
Yeah, of course. But what I mean is that if the mother has loads of children to look after, that's going to be worse for her, especially if she's not got another person around
to help. Not necessarily. Yeah, but you're not... So I feel like you're forgetting that the mother would also want to have as much diversity in her offspring as possible, because that would then increase the chances of her sort of DNA being passed on, right?
Yeah.
Because you have one partner who has a genetic anomaly that makes them very susceptible to one specific disease, right?
Yeah.
If you only mate with that one, if that disease comes about, then your offspring is likely to sort of die from that. But if you've mated with multiple partners, then that disease is only going to wipe out one of your offspring.
Yeah, I guess I just take issue with the idea that the male is incentivized to stick around in order to prevent the partner from cheating, as opposed to the male is incentivized to stick around by the fact that children that had their in the past, children that had the father stick around were more likely to make it to adulthood, and those are the ones that propagated their genes.
Well, there are multiple factors involved, right? So obviously, this is just a potential example.
Yeah, I guess I mean that the effect of the partner father sticking around is that the mother might be less likely to have sex with other men, but it's not. That's an effect. It's as opposed to the mother not sleeping with another man would make that child more likely to have less brothers and sisters, for example, or less brothers and sisters with different fathers, and that might make it more likely to survive. But also the father sticking around would also make it more like, or potentially make it more likely to survive.
Yeah, look, okay, put it this way, right? So I'll just read out this full quote here, right?
Yeah.
And I'll probably clear things up here. So the quote is saying, "It may be because human babies need a lot of looking after and stable couples can share the parenting burden, or it could be because men want to stay as close to prevent their partners from cheating, and it could also be a strategy that women evolved to discourage men from killing infants that they suspected were not theirs." I feel like you're getting very sort of hung up on this not being what you think would be the reason for it, but it's just a suggestion. And both of them, I think, are equally as valid as the other.
Yeah, it's just they're not necessarily detanglable from each other, I guess is the point.
Yeah, no, it's just a suggestion. But one could follow the other, like they could both be the same. It doesn't hugely matter. The fact is we don't know. But here are some sort of things that might drive the pressure towards monogamy. So parental care costs and benefits, offspring need, infanticide, cost and benefits of multiple mating, mate competition, and the potential for mate guarding and resource use. There's a whole paper called Why Monogamy, A Review of Potential Ultimate Drivers, which you should look into if you want to know a little bit more about why monogamy might have developed out of more sort of polyamorous structures in early humans. But first, next, let's go on to quickly some myths and misconceptions about polyamory. I kind of want to talk about raising kids, because as far as I'm aware, there isn't any evidence of polyamory negatively affecting kids, by which I mean children being raised by polyamorous parents, not children in polyamorous relationships. I feel like that would be harmful.
Yes.
Important clarification.
Yep. And a very important one at that.
So the papers I have seen have limitations, and they're usually surveys, and some are retrospective as opposed to longitudinal. So you're not getting info on how people feel during an experience. You're getting info on how they were feeling during past experiences. And they're also usually surveys of the parents. So you're not really getting the kids' perspective in a lot of them. So they're are all those limitations. It's not necessarily great, but I have found one from 2013, which was done on over 100 families, and they actually interviewed the children, and they found that there generally wasn't a negative impact on them at all. Most kids that were sort of between, I think, the ages of 5 to 8 even knew that they were, that most of them didn't even know that there was a difference between their family and other families. As they get older, you know, towards being more teenagers, they are more sort of, hey, this is how my family is. I don't have a problem with it. If you've got a problem with it, then that's your problem, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The parents had said there were some issues with raising a family with polyamorous relationships, but there were also lots of benefits. I mean, you could share childcare amongst multiple people. And realistically, if you think about it, this isn't very different to having a sort of blended family, right? You know, two parents divorce and then get remarried, and then you've got multiple kids and lots of different sort of relationships there. The difference there, really, is that there's not one sort of, there's not a romantic relationship joining the two sets of parents. There's a past romantic relationship, which is now a platonic one would assume. But it's similar in structure in the sense that you have multiple adults raising multiple children. You know what I mean?
Mm. So in these situations, is it, obviously there'll be different ones there'll be differences, but this is both sort of almost like from the child's perspective, it looks like a monogamous relationship, but the parents might also have other partners, but the parents live together, and also possibly relationship structures whereby there are more than two
adults in the home or more than two adults who regularly look after the child.
Yeah, so what it says about that is that kids usually don't think of adults in terms of their relationships with each other. They don't think, this is my dad and this is my dad's boyfriend. They think, this is my dad and this is the guy that brings me Legos. He's very cool and I like him. Yeah. You know, like, kids aren't, kids aren't sitting there thinking Legos. About what your relationship with a person is. They're thinking what their own relationship with a person is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we tend to forget about that because kids talk about their mum and their dad. But kids don't talk about their mum and their dad in terms of them being husband and wife.
Yeah.
Kids talk about their mum and their dad in terms of, this is my mother.
This is my
mum. This is my father.
This is my dad. Yeah.
Whatever's going on between them, I don't know or care about. They are mine.
There's nothing intrinsically... Sorry, there's nothing intrinsic about a kid sort of just coming to the conclusion of, wait a minute, this isn't a heterosexual monogamous relationship between two married people. What's going on here? Like, no kid is like thinking like that in any capacity. That's something very much imparted upon them by society.
Absolutely.
Provided the relationship works out, which I'm very, very grateful that that study exists, because I didn't know that there was any study that proved that it was not a harmful thing. But I imagine that there are difficulties and benefits to it in the same way that a monogamous raising of a child would be beneficial or difficult in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what the parents were saying in response to this, that there are benefits and there are drawbacks. But it's obviously not, there's obviously not more drawbacks than there are benefits to the point where they're saying, we can't do this anymore. Mm. Obviously, it's different between people. I would say, though, that I don't think this necessarily proves that there is no harm. I wouldn't go as far to say that. I mean, they did look at 100 families. They did talk to the kids. It's just one study. There are limitations. Further studies are needed. But I think it's safe to say there aren't any studies that show that there is specific harm done to children when they're raised by a sort of polyamorous family.
Polyfamily.
See, what we've done now is we've combined it in a portmanteau in such a way that it just forms the original word. Genius!
Well, perfect. So, yeah, I mean, look, there doesn't seem to be any evidence showing that kids are negatively impacted by being raised by multiple people. As they say, it takes a village to raise a child, so why don't you just kiss the
rest of the village.
Yeah, kiss the whole village.
Kiss the whole village. So
come raise my baby.
Before we finish off today, I want to talk a little bit about the stigma that polyamorous people face. There are some effects of it. I'm sure Connor can enlighten us on those, but I just briefly want to touch on a couple that I've read specifically about. There is a sort of known amount of stress that comes with being polyamorous, not just in general with dealing with multiple relationships, but instead dealing with the sort of societal expectations and reactions to your relationships. And there's also the main one is the lack of access to certain rights. So marriage and children, all of these sort of things are set up for two people. And if you are more than two people, well, pick your favorite.
Form a company.
A partnership. Which can be seen as a single person nowadays.
Yes, it's one agent.
But yeah. I mean, Connor, do you want to elaborate on any of that at all?
I think that's, I mean, structurally, yes. Things aren't arranged in a capacity that allows for polyamorous relationships to exist with the same kind of rights and recognition by the state as monogamous relationships are, but to a very certain degree, and this is very much my personal perspective as someone I'm not a fan of this state, not a fan of it at all. I think that to a certain degree that there isn't. This is less a capacity of monogamous couples are privileged in having all of this stuff, and polyamorous couples and polyamorous couples aren't. I think it's more of a case of actually the entire system itself needs a major, major rework. The idea that, I mean, for example, the idea of like having when you get married, you get tax credits or deductibles on your tax. If you decide to marry another person, like that's a wild incentive to engage in a practice that many people, I'm sure, would otherwise probably not want to necessarily do. It's a common thing that I hear, like, all of my friends talking about, like, with their partners, is like, oh, we can always get married for tax purposes. It's like, what is that? That's dreadful. So I think the idea that monogamous people are sort of more privileged in that capacity than polyamorous people is sort of the incorrect framing of it. It's more a case of seeing that the system itself is has major, major faults in it. But in terms of a more interpersonal, issues, I know that, for example, whenever I have been seeing someone to the capacity of, you know, like, we're meeting the family, or even they tell their family about me or the like, I know that it is often a difficult conversation to have with adults that just don't get it, who view it as just wrong. Mm-hmm. And that is difficult. Like, very, like, my mum, my dad, I've talked to them about it, and they are beautiful, lovely people. They've been incredibly accepting. Love that for them. Love that for me as well. But I know that that isn't the norm. And it's sort of like, you know, it's not just within dating as well, but there have been sort of relationships with friends that I found that when I talk about polyamory, they just sort of either view it as an inherently negative thing or a sort of childish thing that I'll grow out of at some point. I'm just like, oh, so when are you going to settle down? That kind of stuff. And it's, you know, just very minor. And I can water off a duck's back. I don't really mind it because I'm secure in of myself of what I want and what I'm about. But I know that sort of like for a lot of people, those sort of like consistent microaggressions are just horrible to have to deal with. On top of the systemic invalidity of one's relationships.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up. I mean, I've got a paper that you could probably check out down below that kind of talks a little bit about why they think there is this stigma against polyamory. I won't go too deeply into it, but essentially it talks about different ways that people tend to live their lives, sort of fast history, fast life history and slow life history. Essentially, fast life history is, you know, is a sort of doing lots of different things very early, sort of having lots of kids early on in your life. And slow life history is about taking a sort of more, I guess, slow, measured approach to your life events and having fewer children later on in life. And I think generally when you look at it, people that are polyamorous are made up more of people that sort of have fast life history. But then, I mean, I would definitely look into this study because what I've got here is that it's kind of odd. It starts talking about how fast life history can be associated with teen pregnancy, absent fathers, and higher crime rates. Like, those can all be indicators for fast life history. So I feel like there's some confounding factors there. But essentially the conclusion that it comes to is that people that are consensually non-monogamous or polyamorous might be experiencing some stigma from people who have sort of slow life history and see fast life history as being sort of threatening in that sense, because there is a certain competition to fast life history. I mean, I'm not saying this is exactly why the stigma is there. It was just an interesting paper that I found that I'm recommending to all of you listening.
See, that's quite interesting, because on sort of like the topic of pregnancy specifically, I know that polyamorous people are some of the most sexually healthy people that I have ever met, because you need to be. You need to go and get regular checkups. If you're seeing multiple people, even if you aren't like having sex with multiple people, even if you're just seeing people in a romantic capacity, like the amount of like everyone who I know who was polyamorous, regular checkups at STD clinics just to make sure they are the first people to, you know, oftentimes, you know, when you find yourself like diagnosed with an STD, thankfully that's never been me, hallelujah. But like, I know that a lot of people who have, they are instantaneously into people's messages and into texts just being like, hey, this has happened, please go get yourself tested. Whereas I know a lot of monogamous people, especially when I was in university, who would be like, oh, I'm really embarrassed, I got chlamydia. I don't really want to tell anybody, including the people I slept with, so I'm just gonna let them find out on their own.
They'll figure it out, won't they?
Yeah.
But it's that communication thing. So the idea of like and this, again, this is mainly from my perspective of, like, polyamorous people that I know, but I have, like, whenever there has been sort of, like, a pregnancy scare or something like that, it is usually met with not only sort of, like, solidarity and people openly communicating about what's happening and a very sort of progressive and very accepting and understanding response. But also, it doesn't happen very often because you use protection. Like, you just have to. If you're seeing multiple people and they are seeing multiple people, you have to use it. People who are polyamorous are incredibly safe with their sex life. So the teen pregnancy thing, I find very, I guess, like, that could happen before you become polyamorous.
So, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the sort of next part of what I was going to say on this paper, is that they're talking, not necessarily saying that being consensually non-monogamous or polyamory, that engaging in either of those then sort of leads to those things, but rather that potentially people that have a sort of more fast life history will find themselves in these kinds of relationships or practicing that sort of lifestyle. And because there is so much sort of support and openness and all of these sort of factors within sort of polyamory, it then sort of, you don't then see people that are polyamorous having all of these sort of indicators, you know, sort of pregnancy and, like, sort of, say, poor sexual health or a not necessarily open approach to sexual health. Mm. You won't necessarily see that in polyamorous people. What it suggests is that potentially people with fast life history have sort of consensual non-monogamy and polyamory almost as an outlet, which then results in them not acting in the way that would be typical of people that have sort of fast life history. It's an interesting read, I guess. I'm not saying that I fully agree with everything that's in there. I'm not saying that I necessarily fully understand everything that's in there, but it's it's definitely interesting in what it sort of posits. Essentially, what it's saying is that sort of polyamory provides this really great sort of structure that allows you to sort of be more open, but also more communicative, you know, and that sort of necessity of communication then results in, I guess, healthier relationships in a group of people that may be somewhat predisposed to having more typically unhealthy relationships. That makes sense.
Yeah. Like, it's almost like it provides a structure which they weren't provided by society.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, this gives, helps. It's like almost like the sexual scripting stuff that we talk about. Talked about with Ian, where it's like, if you see a sort of example of, like, how you see an example of, like, oh, that's how I am and that's how things can go for me and they can be okay, you feel better. And if the sort of traditional way of being in relationships and relating to other people didn't work for you and you didn't have a structure that worked for you, you might be more likely to sort of be a bit more chaotic because you don't have any and that might lead you down into places where you're, for example, getting pregnant earlier in life. And then if you then come across a community that helps you make sense of who you are, feel okay and feel like things can be okay for you and give you a structure to follow, then great, you're all sorted.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of studies, there's limitations on the sort of why and how things lead into one another, or how sort of different observations actually interact with one another. And in this case, bear in mind that what I've said about people with fast life history, what they sort of present about people with fast life history, that doesn't inherently apply to polyamorous people at all. I just need to make that 100% clear, that what you say about people fast life history does not apply to polyamory. In fact, it's almost the opposite. Polyamory, it tends to, as I said, promote that sort of more open communication. And if you're looking at a healthy polyamorous relationship, you're not necessarily going to see all of those same outcomes that you would see in people with fast life history.
Yeah.
So that is everything I've looked at on polyamory this week. If you'd like to look at something more specific, for example, polyamory and raising children, or how polyamory turned into monogamy in early humans, anything that we've spoken about today that you want to know more about specifically, head over to our Patreon. You can join that, and at certain tiers you can suggest a topic every single month for the vote. And if you want to become an executive producer, you can go ahead and just tell us what topic you want us to cover. So head to our Patreon at patreon.com/SciGuys to tell us what to do next. But I think it's time for a quick fire quiz.
Ooh, dun, 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 dun.
Polyamory edition.
So the rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I will ask one question. That's one question between the three of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after I finish asking the question wins. What do they win, Jim?
A good polyamorous relationship.
You gosh darn right.
There you go.
Luke, just one.
Just one.
As you get more points. Yeah.
Luke, what is your buzzer?
Polly.
Jim, what is your buzzer?
Amorous.
Connor, what is your buzzer?
Relationship.
Very good. So my question for you today, and remember, I have to finish asking the question before you can buzz in with your answer. My question is, what percentage of mammals are monogamous?
Polly.
Amorous.
9%.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct.
Yeah.
Well done. I'm sorry, Connor, you don't win healthy polyamory.
I never said healthy.
You win lots of unhealthy.
I thought you said healthy.
I never said healthy.
What did you say?
I said
a little.
I said little.
Oh, so sorry, you get no polyamorous relationships ever again. Yeah. Sorry. It's not happening. No.
That's it.
That's going to suck for a lot of people.
Got a lot of phone calls to make.
But unfortunately, you will not be sucking for a lot of people. Oh. Before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Rosa Rodriguez and Tanito. And thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday. And why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, here on YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCory everywhere.
Follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
And you can follow me at Spice8Rack everywhere.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.